This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Among stories of Middle East refugees and stock market jitters, we find brief notices that species are disappearing rapidly all over the world. In a scientific journal and a new book, famed scientists Paul and Ann Ehrlich warn that humans are driving the sixth great mass extinction here on Earth. Just released in September, their new book is titled The Annihilation of Nature, Human Extinction of Birds and Mammals. As an author and co-author of more than 40 books, Paul R. Ehrlich is the Bing Professor of Population Studies and the President of the Center for Conservation Biology at Stanford University, and we reached him there. Paul, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Nice to be back.
Your book title uses the word annihilation. Is that just for sensationalism, or do you mean it?
Well, we mean it because basically we're losing the biodiversity of the planet, the only known living companions we have in the entire universe, and they're all critically important to us. Not every species, but virtually every population plays a role in the system that supports our lives. So, yeah, scientists are very scared about this. They're particularly scared because people don't really understand much about the threat. And that's too bad, but it's a big threat, just as big and involved with such things as climate change.
And you're right about the current times as the sixth great extinction. Can you tell us when the previous great dying of species happened and how serious was it?
Well, there are five previous ones. I can't enumerate every one right off the top of my head, but the one that virtually everybody has heard of occurred about 66 million years ago when an extraterrestrial object hit the Earth and wiped out, among other things, all the dinosaurs except for the birds, and caused a horrendous decline in the diversity of life. Now, one of the things we have to remember is that was more than 65 million years before anything like a human being appeared on the planet. So what we're facing now is a catastrophic event, along with a civilization of more than 7 billion people trying to survive. So we're in a much different situation. The dinosaurs disappeared. Hopefully we won't.
How do we know, though, Paul, that these extinctions are being driven by humans rather than being part of some natural cycle so often found in Earth's long history?
Well, again, we have had five natural events, but the way we know that human beings are doing it now is simply a large set of observations plus correlations. We've looked at very conservative estimates of how many species we've lost over the last few hundred years, and we've looked at very conservative estimates of the rates of extinction that occurred between the mass extinction events. In other words, evolution is always going on. New species are always being formed, and they're many times going extinct. And there has been over all of our history a steady production of species and a steady loss of species as various things drove them extinct. But there are these five outstanding events when all of a sudden the rate of extinction went way, way, way up. And so what has been tested scientifically is, where is the rate of extinction today compared with the rate of extinction in the past that was standard, that was not in one of the great extinction episodes, that was a background rate, the one that was always going on. And looking conservatively at both ends of the story, it turns out that the extinction rate today is already somewhere between 10 and 100 or more times the background rate, which shows we're starting into a vast new extinction, and it's clearly being caused by human beings. I mean, virtually anybody who's looked at what's going on in nature can see that extinction is an ongoing process because many species on the planet, maybe most of them, are losing populations all the time. And losing populations is how you become extinct. In other words, when the last population is gone, the species is extinct.
So how does this book relate to the scientific study on extinction you and Anne and Geraldo Ceballos published in June of this year in the journal Science Advances?
Well, the book and the paper are related to each other very closely. The book gives a lot more explanation for lay people of what the values we're losing are and where the losses are. We're trying to bring to people more of an emotional feel of what we're losing, because most people now are isolated in cities, don't know much about what goes on in the natural world, don't know where their food comes from. For example, one of the extinction problems that's very, very serious is the loss of pollinators that are necessary for our crops. If a person thinks that their food comes from the supermarket, they don't get what the real picture is. And for example, if we lost just the honeybees from North America, and they are in trouble, the cost to us in nutrition would be about $18 billion and a considerable loss in the nutritional value of our diets. And yet, if the honeybees just disappeared from North America, there would be no species extinction, just an extinction of populations. So you got to look at the world as that supports us as running by the populations of millions of species, and we're losing the populations rapidly, and losing the populations leads eventually to the loss of the species. By the time a species is endangered, the value of the populations to human beings is way down. For example, if we had killed off all the honeybees except one population in Central Africa where they originated, we still wouldn't have lost the species, but we would have lost all the pollination services worth many billions of dollars. So you can't just look at it as loss of species. You got to look at it as loss of biodiversity.
Now, in a review of your new book in the Los Angeles Times, Fred Pierce says there have been only 800 extinctions registered in the last 400 years. He thinks you're being too emotional about all this, Paul. What do you say?
Well, first of all, I am emotional about it. Second of all, poor Fred Pierce is a very confused man and has been for a long time. He, for example, says that the only problem is not population size, it's just per capita consumption. He doesn't seem to understand the two multiply together, and saying something like that is like saying the area of a rectangle is the fault of the width, not the length. We say in the book that you don't have to know we're losing biodiversity because we're losing habitat any more than we have to know what every grain of sand on the beach is in order to know a beach is eroding away. And he says, no, you got to count the grains of sand. In other words, he does not understand the environment. He does not understand science. But for some reason, he gets to publish nonsense. And, you know, there's nothing you can do about that.
Well, we know there are climate deniers. Do you think there are also developing extinction deniers?
There are people who don't want to face that we're facing an existential challenge in climate, in loss of biodiversity, in what we're doing with toxics, in the plastic microparticles problem that's developing, and so on. And the scientific community has been very forthcoming on this, and yet you may have noticed there have been a couple of debates in which no serious problem has been discussed. Haven't talked at all about the population problem, about the climate problem, about the toxics problem, about the extinction problem, and so on. And yet these are what concern the people who are really interested in seeing that our civilization persists.
I thought birds would be the great survivors. They can move away from threats towards better living zones, but your team writes that they are in trouble. Why is that?
Well, they can move, but unfortunately, we're destroying the places they can move to very often. We're also putting up barriers that prevent them from moving as far and as fast as they'd like to. In other words, there are all kinds of problems with the refueling stations for the tropical birds that spend the summer in North America and then return to the tropics. So some birds are very, very resilient. Others aren't. That's a general story with animals. That is, some are more easily threatened by things like climate change than others. And all these problems are tied tightly together because, of course, extinction of populations of trees is now increasing our chances of more climate change. So this is a huge nexus of problems that everybody should be educated about, but which, unfortunately, most of our politicians are not. And that's one of the things we're hoping to do in the annihilation of nature is bring it home in a more personal way to see what the birds and mammals are that are under threat, why they're under threat, and what that means to us, and what we might be able to do to change it.
And animals most like us, carnivore hunters, are becoming extinct first and foremost. Could you tell us, Paul, about a couple of the great creatures in jeopardy and their chances for survival?
Well, one good example, an iconic animal, is the lion, whose populations are declining rapidly. They used to extend all the way to India from Africa, but now they're refined, except for a very few in one part of India. They're confined to Africa, and they're suffering from distemper, from domestic dog contacts. They're being hunted still in places, and unfortunately, their bones are now being featured in Chinese medicine. Same thing with the black rhinoceros, which is now so endangered in South Africa that they're shipping their black rhinos to Botswana, which is in Africa the best country in terms of their of how they deal with conservation, because poaching is so critical on the black rhinos because their horns are thought to be aphrodisiacs in Chinese medicine. And they're also supposed to be aphrodisiacs when you make them into daggers for the Middle East. And one of the saddest things I've heard recently is we thought Viagra might save the rhino because Viagra actually works. But it turns out now the dealers are grinding Viagra into the rhino horn so that the rhino horn really works. So those are a couple of famous cases of things that are in deep trouble, but there are many, many others.
Wow, that's pitiful. You know, here in Canada, Paul, we just had a hockey player charged for taking macho pictures of himself with a grizzly bear he illegally slaughtered. And then there's the dentist who shot Cecil the lion. Is this partly just a testosterone problem, as you've been speaking about?
Well, I think you can imagine my opinion of the dentist. And, you know, if you want to actually be a sportsman, then go hunt a lion with a .22 rifle, maybe, and not with somebody guarding you. But it's unfortunate, I have to say, or I shouldn't say it's unfortunate, the hunting is a minor factor compared to destruction of habitat and the things I was talking about in Africa, the poaching on the rhinos, and particularly rhinos and elephants are in trouble because of the market in rhino horn and in ivory. There's an animal called the scaly anteater. There's another name for them which skips my mind now, but there's 13 species that are being killed all over the world because the scales play a role in Chinese medicine. So there's a huge trade in wildlife, but hunting per se is mostly serious when poor people hunt for bushmeat. And, of course, that's another problem that we have to face, that there are a lot of people in the world who don't have enough to eat. And if you don't have enough to eat, it's the ground pangolin. The pangolin is this name I was coming up with. But the pangolins are hunted to be eaten. They're a delicacy in parts of China. But, again, there are a lot of poor people who get their food directly from nature. It's called bushmeat. And who can blame them? We got to find ways to control that trade and make sure everybody has a decent diet, which we don't do at the moment.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock, and I'm Alex Smith, talking with the famous ecologist Paul R. Ehrlich about our destruction of Earth's other creatures. Well, you mentioned habitat loss, Paul. In a developed world, we may not slaughter species directly, but we steal their habitat for resources, new shopping malls and suburbs. Why isn't there a plan to save the species, or is there one?
Well, there is some countries pay more attention than we do. Botswana is way ahead of the United States in conservation. Mexico is way ahead of the United States in conservation. But in the United States, a strip mall is always valued more than habitat for organisms that we either appreciate or that are part of our life support system. And that's sad. And again, it's not debated. In other words, most people don't know there's a real conservation problem, don't know that we're entering the great extinction crisis that could end our civilization. And that's sad. That's why I'm raving at you on the radio.
Did you go into how climate change will speed up this extinction event in your book?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Climate. Several things are missing from the media. For example, have you heard anybody point out that the more people there are, the greater the climate change is going to be because each person contributes greenhouse gases to the atmosphere? The climate population connection has not been made. The population extinction connection has not been made, and the connection between climate change and extinction, because, of course, climate change changes habitats very rapidly. I mean, we're for instance, right now on the West Coast in California, I think in British Columbia as well, the forests are being changed dramatically by drought and new fire regimes, and that means the inhabitants of those forests are going to have great trouble and are going to be more threatened with extinction.
Do you think it's possible that DNA from disappearing species could be saved to bring them back later in a more ecologically sane world? Is such a project in the works?
Well, there are some people trying to do that, but it's actually a total waste of time. The basic thing is it's so much easier to save the habitat while it still exists and save the organisms while they still exist. The so-called de-extinction movement is basically made work for idiots. And it's one of the saddest things because, I like Jurassic Park. Great movie, but scientifically nonsense. And that is something that's being, it has a huge threat because it makes people who are ignorant of science believe they don't have to worry because all we have to do is put the several billion populations we have on the planet now that are genetically different in freezers and everything will be fine.
Well, we've just received a new study saying that half the fish in the sea have disappeared since you and I were born. It's just another brief headline, though, Paul, competing with Hollywood news and the stock market. How can giant and dangerous trends like the ones we're talking about get past that everyday roar of sensational media?
Well, I think you would say probably for you and for me, if we knew how, we'd sure as hell do it. We keep trying. But I was once told by Ben Bradley that I had suggested to him that the Washington Post every day put in numbers about how much CO2 there is in the atmosphere, how big the human population was, how many people were starving, and so on. And he told me, no, he says, we don't want to have numbers in the newspaper. Nobody likes numbers. And I said, have you ever looked at the sports or the financial pages? And he said, he kind of backed off on that. But then he told me that he wanted his science reporters to be utterly ignorant of science so they could be unbiased. And I said, do you hire sports reporters who don't know what a strike and a ball is? The media has serious, serious problems, as I think you know.
Yep. Well, in your book, there's a lot of gorgeous photographs. How were they selected and why are they there?
Well, the whole idea is to make people know what we're losing. Most people don't pay attention. And so we selected what we thought were a lot of attractive and interesting animals. We took some of our own favorite pictures. There's one in there of one of the most spectacular sights I've ever seen that I wish every human being had a chance to see with something like 3,000 wildebeest, a herd of about 3,000 wildebeest storming into the Mara River and crossing as fast as possible so they can avoid being eaten by crocodiles. And that's the kind of scene that, you know, we had an abundance in the planet during the Pleistocene, is very rare today, ought to be preserved, and we ought to find ways to get as many people to see it as possible. But short of seeing it, a movie or a picture is the best we can do.
So you're the head of a Center for Conservation Biology at Stanford. What are the steps needed to save what species are remaining, and what agencies need to take leadership in this?
Well, the most basic steps, of course, as we've published many times, is to reduce the scale of the human enterprise. There are many too many people, and they are consuming much too much, many of them, and too many of them don't have enough to eat, so they don't consume enough. And so unless we have to tackle the population and consumption problem and the notion that we can grow forever, we have this faith-based economic system which says on a finite planet we can continue to grow forever and not worry about anything. And those are the fundamental things that need to be changed. A lot of scientists are trying to change them. A very famous climate scientist has gone to jail trying to get people to close down coal-fired plants, which we should be doing immediately. Those are the main things to do while we do the standard conservation things in hopes of saving some of the parts, because it's going to take a long time to humanely reduce the size of the human population, to convince people they don't have to have 50 new iPhones every day, and so on and so forth. So we got a lot to do, and unhappily, there are not many people doing it.
Now, Paul Ehrlich, you don't have a reputation for looking on the bright side of things. Is there any hope for the threatened animal life, or do we just shrug it off and hope it never gets to us?
I got a standard answer for that. I think I used to say that I am very pessimistic about where we're going, but I'm very optimistic about where we could go. I now would say I'm still optimistic about where we could go if we choose to do so, but my pessimism is increased by such things as having political debates in which the critical existential issues are not even discussed. So, yeah, there's a lot we could do. Boy, we could start right now, and it would cheer me up and cheer up my colleagues very much. But we're not doing it. In other words, we're still not making the big changes in the use of fossil fuels we should. We still have people who think that it's okay to have five children. Matter of fact, it may not even be okay to have two anymore. So when we hear population discussed in the U.S. like it is, say, in Australia, I'll become more cheery, but I'm not looking forward to it.
And do we hide this fear of annihilation from school children? What do we tell the kids?
Well, what we have to tell the kids is it's going to be in their laps. These changes, we're leaving them a world that is in tough shape, and part of their job is going to be to have to help dig us out of it. You know, I love talking to the people in middle school and so on, where they haven't yet formed their views but can understand everything. And children can be a big force for conservation. You know, when the Exxon Valdez oil spill occurred, the kids of the Exxon executives in Alaska gave them hell. They came home and said, "Daddy, why is your company doing this? We need more of that."
So as we wrap up, is there anything I've missed, Paul, that you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Well, I'd like to leave with the listeners that they shouldn't take my word on it. That they should look in the literature, see what the scientific community says, learn about these problems, and then do something about it. I think every functional human being who is rich enough not to have to just worry about where his or her food is coming from should be putting something like 10% of their time into one of the many places in which people can act. If you want to do something, go to mahb.stanford.edu, mahb.stanford.edu. Become a mobster and help save the world.
We've been talking about disappearing nature with the renowned ecologist Paul R. Ehrlich, with the Mexican ecologist Geraldo Ceballos. Paul and Ann Ehrlich have just released their new book, The Annihilation of Nature, Human Extinction of Birds and Mammals. You can find links to the book and the science behind this conversation in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Paul Ehrlich, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
My pleasure as always. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.